You are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. In today's Sånt är livet, or That's Life here in Sweden, we are moving outside of Sweden to find out ways Empowered, an Australian innovative social enterprise, has been able to successfully support over thousands of young Australians, including those with disabilities, finding work. With me on the mobile, I am speaking with Natalia Josephs, the founder and managing director of Empowered, with a fascinating background as a musician, a former international model, an author and entrepreneur, about her thoughts about understanding the importance of changing our dated ideas about etiquette, dress code and manners, yet recognizing that these are still important in today's world of work, and especially finding employment. Hello, Natalia, and welcome.
Hi, Lisa.
How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, very good. It's very hot here today.
Okay,
very warm.
Oh, okay. How hot?
33 degrees. Yeah,
That sounds lovely. And you are, of course, near the ocean.
Yes, we are. So we've got lovely sea breezes coming in, which is nice.
Fantastic. I am so happy you're with us today, and very curious, of course, about your work. How important is, do you believe, etiquette is today in our world?
Well, first of all, I need to say that humans are basically wired to connect. So we're designed to be tribal, to be part of groups. We're not born with these skills. We have brain wiring, but we have to learn how to use that wiring. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, from a sociological point of view, specific group behaviours are completely normal, because humans are tribal and all groups have specific attributes that enable identification and, you know, acceptance into a group. And, you know, these can include behaviours, language, dress codes, for example. And some of these are explicit and some, of course, are less obvious.
Right.
I guess we'd probably call these basic cultural norms wherever we live and wherever we are. So we all belong to groups, and this part of belonging is part of being human. And you'll probably remember that famous experiment where it was found that, you know, social exclusion was as bad for your health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. I can't remember who did that, but it was quite an interesting experiment. So the urge to belong is actually really strong. It's when social exclusion happens that it can mean some people are excluded from opportunities or social benefits. It becomes a problem. So if we talk about etiquette, we talk about a set of social rules and behaviours that are in line with norms that are observed by a specific society, a social class, or, you know, a social group. And it sort of it's always been there, but it became really apparent in the 1700s when the rules of etiquette in France, where it sort of, I guess, it all started, were really complicated and age-specific, and they were designed to exclude the commoners from elite and royalty. So etiquette actually translates typically as, or specifically as, ticket or tag. So etiquette is your ticket to certain social groups, and you're tagged or identified by specific cues, for example, behaviour and dress.
Right.
So in the 1800s, you know, people wanted to identify with the social elite, especially the particularly the mobile middle class and the bourgeoisie. So they adopted the behaviours of the upper class.
Mm.
So socially ambitious people of the middle class has learned to practice the rules of social etiquette to edge their way upwards. We live in a meritocracy now, where hopefully we don't have these social classes as much. So learning these rules was to avoid exclusion from certain opportunities and groups. So they're basically a way of, I guess, identifying your social class specifically. If you look at etiquette from a very basic and raw angle, does that make sense?
Sure.
But good manners are based in kindness and consideration and respect, and they encourage inclusion. So they're different.
Right. So you suggest then that etiquette changes from culture to culture. Can you provide examples?
Okay. So there are crossovers from the rules of etiquette and good manners in every culture. But good manners intrinsically come from who you are inside, and they're generally cross-cultural. They're great indicators of better management skills, team skills, compassion skills, and of course, they enable us to make lifelong friends who look after each other because they care,
right,
not because, you know, we have an expectation of a return. So I guess you could summarize etiquette as a set of rules that are learned. So each culture has a set of rules that are specific to that culture, and you learn those rules from a very young age. They're designed to exclude outsiders from a group, and therefore they're based in exclusion rather than inclusion.
Mm.
They change from culture to culture. They change over time, and they say nothing about the person practicing those skills other than they've learned them.
Right.
I mean, some of the cruelest people in history have been skilled in the art of etiquette. You know, all it says really is that somebody's learned the rules. And I'm sure Josef Mengele had very good etiquette skills.
Yes. But Natalia, I'm interested in what are the etiquette skills in Australia?
So we're based in the British system. So, for example, how we introduce each other, how we communicate with each other. There are certain things that are based on that system. I think some of these have now been diluted, but I think that if we teach our children these very, very strict rules, that although some of them can be very valuable because they give you a kind of a foothold in a social situation, I think that they can be very excluding.
Okay.
And I don't think that can be a positive thing, because when we exclude people, we tend to think we're better than them. Does that kind
yep.
of... Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
When we sign off, we don't sign off with yours faithfully. We tend to sign off with yours sincerely, because that's a much more, I guess, in a job application, it's much more appropriate. In our emails, we're much more casual in the way that we write our emails. We might sign off with cheers or, you know, something like that, rather than yours faithfully, which would have been originally, when we were writing letters, the way that we signed off. I believe that, you know, such skills as small talk, ability to introduce people,
right,
you know, these basic skills, but nonetheless, they have relaxed a lot more today than they were. For example, in medieval times, it was considered to be polite to use a knife to pick your teeth at the dinner table, and we'd throw our bones and bits of food on the floor. But I'm pretty sure if you went into a restaurant today, they're not going to think that that's a very good thing to do.
You'd be thrown out.
Yeah. But on the other hand, if we dine out formally, in a relatively formal situation, we might have our utensils laid out for us as we go, which is much easier. The wait person will sort of, you know, give us our knives and forks as we decide what we're going to eat and as we go. But 50 years ago, if we dined out formally, we'd probably have a fish knife or a steak knife and a soup spoon and a dessert spoon. And, you know, there was a whole range of cutlery laid out on the table when we sat down. And we needed to identify these within our cultural, you know, area or rules of etiquette. And if you didn't know how to use those, it could be quite embarrassing for someone. And people would understand that you weren't part of that you know, elite group. So you would teach your children so that they could mingle with a wider range of people to learn those rules.
So how important do you think, now we are online, so we talk online, whether it's dating someone online, how has that communication changed from, for example, and I'm thinking, of course, etiquette, how we did date face to face?
I am not, unfortunately, very familiar with dating online. However, I do understand what you're saying. It's very common. People do now. It's perfectly acceptable to date online. I guess people talk in, you know, they type their answers rather than, so they write their answers rather, or they text their answers rather, and questions, rather than speaking them face to face.
Right.
I think in a sense we've lost a certain level of human communication with online. However, we're able to make more friends online perhaps, or more people that we can get to know. I know that there's a number, and I'm just trying to think of the man who invented the number, a British researcher, Dunbar's number,
right?
Which is exactly a certain number that you can have in your friendship base in Facebook that you actually know.
Yeah.
The rest of them are kind of contacts that know of, but you would have a personal relationship with maybe 10 or 15 and that's it. So we still keep those numbers the same, even though we might have been in a big tribe and doing face-to-face earlier. Now we're doing it online. We still maintain those friendship numbers, those close friendship numbers, where we know people individually.
Right. So when I'm thinking another important aspect of particularly, you know, meeting with people or looking for a job or even negotiating different workplaces relate to dress code and our physical appearance. What do you think? How important do you think this is?
Well, it's a really interesting question. It's a really good question because physical appearance has always been important. And there have been thousands of research papers written on the advantages of looking good, inverted commas. But they are, these are culturally specific. What's happened with internet is that we've now got a look that is meant to be good, and that's changing or more attractive. So people are looking at pictures of people internationally and it's becoming less cross-cultural. Yes, it does. So I guess there's a certain look that we all aspire to. Most of this is based on a human instinct to be normal, you know, as per our cultural norms. But that's now crossing over and becoming sort of international. We have a sort of an international look. And of course, young women are, biologically is seen as more attractive because it symbolizes fertility, and men, young men, are seen with strength and endurance. So we sort of try and maintain this look of youth and vitality as long as we possibly can. Whereas, you know, before we sort of took older people on and we had respect for their age, we seem to have lost that in a sort of, in a way.
Why?
People are, well, I unfortunately, I think it's something that we've carried this youth, this kind of youth thing into our cultures in really radical ways because we've lost our respect for the elderly. So we fight to look young because we sort of fear the exclusion of old age that might come with old age, you know. We know that older people are more likely to be neglected and discriminated against, whether it be, you know, in the workplace or outside the workplace. And let me say that often older people are discriminated against with people who've got very good etiquette skills. So, you know, they say all the right things and they follow the rules, but the genuine respect and generosity of compassion and behaviours that accompany manners or social intelligence are just not there. Today, it's more a case of ticking boxes than caring interactions. So when you go into a business or you're interacting with people who are older, it's more about being seen as being caring rather than actually caring. When you're interacting with people with disabilities, it's more about being seen to being, you know, interacting with people with disabilities in an appropriate way rather than actually genuinely caring.
So it's very superficial.
Well, most of our physical biases are automatic and hidden, and I always recommend the Harvard University Implicit Association Test, which you can take online free. It's a free online test you can take.
Okay.
And you can discover your hidden biases. I highly recommend that.
Okay.
You just go on and put in Google Harvard Implicit Association Test and it'll come up. And you'll be amazed at your hidden biases. You know, they've got one for fatness and youth and age and colour of skin and, you know, whether you're, you are comfortable with homosexuality, that sort of thing.
So what do you suggest young people, and I'm thinking about when you talk about this youth fixated, we're so youth fixated in whether it's in Australia or here in Sweden, what do you suggest to try to make some change in terms of bringing back a bit more respect for our elderly?
Look, I think that social intelligence, which is what I have as part of my program, I don't believe in teaching strict, you know, focused rules that are hard and fast. I think that we need to set examples to our young people. Young people learn from watching others.
Yep.
They watch their role models. They watch how they behave. So from sports people to world leaders to mums and dads to teachers at school, children do as they see, not necessarily as they're told. So I'm a great believer in radical behaviour. I encourage freedom of speech and out-of-the-box thinking, but not if it hurts others in the process. So I am a great believer in social intelligence, and I think that is manners.
Right. But what do you mean suggesting that manners are cross-cultural? Can you give examples?
Okay. So, for example, listening to someone is good manners, and that's good manners in Japan, in Italy, in, you know, the Middle East, in Australia, in England, in the US, wherever you go, when someone speaks to you, you listen to them.
Right.
That's good manners. And cross-cultural. However, when you're listening to someone, looking at somebody in the eye might be a cultural differentiation. So in our culture, looking somebody in the eye when we're speaking with them is considered polite. But in some cultures, that's a sign of disrespect.
And so you also state that social intelligence is related to manners. Can you explain this further?
Okay, so interpersonal intelligence was defined by Howard Gardner in his theories of multiple intelligences, which you would know about.
Yeah.
And it is the capacity to understand and intentions and motivations of other people.
Yeah.
The desires of other people and being able to work effectively with others, no matter what their cultural, physical or social differences are. So you can walk into a room full of people and you can understand their intentions, their motivations and desires, and you can work with them, you can chat with them, because you're focused on them as an individual rather than sticking to a very set rule of what is appropriate. I guess interpersonal skills can be considered as manner skills, and I guess extreme examples of people with high interpersonal intelligence might be, you know, someone like Mahatma Gandhi or Mother Teresa, because they had the ability to recognize and understand other people's needs, you know, their moods, their desires, their motivations and their intentions.
Hmm.
So we would look to those people as ideals of from the outside, as ideals of human behavior that we would like to emulate.
Hmm.
So I guess with manners, there's a genuine concern for the welfare and feelings of others. And this could be translated into respectful and non-judgmental interactions, or manners, as we say.
Yeah.
I actually really love, I don't know if you know about Professor Marie Hoskins from the University of British Columbia. She wrote a wonderful set of principles in a paper that she wrote called The Five Principles of Cultural Attunement. But I actually think these relate to all cultures and are a kind of a, I guess, a, they kind of put the whole of the idea of manners into a nice little kind of ideal, you know. So the five principles of cultural attunement are, you know, engaging in mutuality, acting with reverence, coming from a place of not knowing, engaging in acts of humility, as well as acknowledging the pain of oppression, whether that be bullying or, you know, people being oppressed in the workplace or whatever. I think that these five principles are so valuable. And I teach these in my program because I think they are a great kind of, I guess, bouncing board for kids to start thinking about their behaviours in social situations.
Whose role, I mean, you are basically answering the next question, which relate to whose role do you think it is to teach young people social skills in a world where Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, and other social media platforms rule today?
Well, I think our role models, I think that we have a lot of not very good role models. I think that we need to look more at the sort of people that we're making into heroes. And when we make them into heroes, we have this habit of making people into these wonderful heroes, and then it's kind of like the tall poppy syndrome. Then we find faults with them.
Hmm.
And then it all comes out and the heroes are kind of crushed and we get another hero.
Yeah.
And I think that's really sad because I think it's really confusing for young people. Hmm. And, you know, I mean, role models that are different to what I believe in, you know, it might be a rap star. It might be a movie star. If they're behaving in ways that are kind and, you know, considerate in their real life, and that's reported in the press and interviews and things like that, young people will read that. when they see people being violent and aggressive and mean-spirited and using awful words to, you know, putting women down and other groups down, I think that's really sad because children are learning from that.
But Natalia, don't you think parents have a role in this and teachers?
Oh, yes, I do. I absolutely do. And I think I said that previously, that, you know, children do what they see. They look at the people around them and they use those as their guiding lights. They look at them and they say, well, you know, mum and dad behave like that, therefore it's okay to behave like that. Or my teacher dresses like that, therefore it's okay for me to dress like that. I think that we need to create role models in our parenting, in our teachers, in our politicians. I mean, you talk to any young person about politicians and they just, they've got no respect for them whatsoever. I mean, it's awful. If you remember that awful scene where a child threw a sandwich at our Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, and it was a male, young male boy. Now, I found that incredibly distressing, not because it was, you know, a male or female, but because it was disrespect to an adult in a social situation. I found that quite distressing, and he didn't really get, people were kind of going, yeah, go for it. You know, they were kind of encouraging that behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that behaviour will then be taken into their adult life and will come out in different ways that perhaps not as, it won't be throwing a sandwich, it might be doing something else that is the same sort of behaviour. So I think it's mostly our role models. So our parents, our teachers, our politicians, you know, our heroes, our sports people, actors, singers, you know, all of the people in the public eye are setting these standards. And I think that we've lost sight of that in many ways.
And that's the power, of course, of social media, because that's where kids and young adults tend to flock, and that's where they get
But if they're taught the right way from a very young age, if they're taught kindness, sharing, you know, to be nice to it, well, nice to, don't like that word nice, but, you know, there's a genuine concern for the welfare and feeling of others. I think if they're taught that from a very young age by their parents, by their carers, by their guardians, whoever are the people around them, if they see people behaving like that, then it doesn't matter what they see on, you know, social media. I think the problem is that children are being exposed to that, but they're not getting the other side as well in a way that's very positive. I think that parents are busy. I think they're rushed. I think kids sit in front of televisions and computer games, and, you know, life is just so busy, and so, you know, everybody wants more of everything, and we just have to spend more time getting more. And I think we lose sight of that.
How do you teach mannerism or social skills in your work?
In my programs.
Yeah.
So I think young people are very astute. I think probably the generations that I teach in my programs are the ages of 13 to 17. Now, those children or those young people, I won't call them children, those young people of that age group are far more worldly and astute than we often give them credit for. They have an incredible capacity for learning. And when you can give them, I guess, the framework and give them a reason for that framework, then they will automatically move towards that. In my programs, I teach them, try to teach them or talk about, not teach them, talk about how our brain works. So if we're feeling suddenly a rush of anger that we can't control, that's coming from our you know, from our amygdala, from our back, from our brain, our reptile brain, our ancient brain.
Right.
If we can ask ourselves a question, why am I feeling like this? It brings everything back into our frontal lobe, into the front part of our brain, and we can control that. We can't control the amygdala. It's an automatic reaction. Our fight and flight is built in there. So if we can bring them forward and teach them how to do that, to utilize that, those little things that they can do, they can learn, why do I feel so angry? And while they're asking themselves that question, they're giving themselves that time to think about their reactions and what they're going to do in that situation, rather than just saying something or doing something that's automatic.
Now, Natalia, you are a former musician, and you have also penned the words to the rap piece of music that I think is just fabulous, and I will actually end the program with that piece of music. But I'm curious to find out, can you explain briefly what is it about and what made you write it?
So when I was delivering the Developing Social Skills in its very early days, I would take the program out to schools and deliver it face-to-face. Most of the programs that we create are beta tested on real kids, real young people, for a long time. So the Developing Social Skills was tested for about 5 years before we actually took it online. And during that time, we were going out to schools where young people's music was very important to them. And rap music was just coming in. And I just love rap music. I just think it's wonderful. Not all of it. I mean, some of it's very, very negative. The language is very negative. But there are some wonderful rap music out there. And I wanted to communicate to young people a message within a format, I guess, that they could understand. And so what we used to do, I used to have a backing, music made up for me by some musicians. And I would take it out to the schools when I did my program. At the very end, I would say, now I want you to write a rap song to this music with your group. There'd be groups of maybe four people together.
Right.
And you can, but I want you to put everything you've learned in the program, I want you to put that into the rap song. And I want you to perform that rap song in front of the rest of the class. And so they would come up with the most wonderful things of what they'd learned in the program. And it was what stood out for them. And then they were able to perform that and in a way, I guess, put that message out to the students. And it was all different perspectives came out of the program. And it was really wonderful, you know, that these young people would stand up and they would, you know, they'd all stand there and they'd dance and they'd do their bit and they'd, you know, do this rap to this rap music and they'd write their own rap song and they'd make all the noises and all of that type of thing. So it was fantastic. So when it went online, I wanted to do the same sort of thing. So I teamed up with a young guy from Canada and he's a rap musician. And I wrote the words to this and I said to him, I want you to, this is my summary, how I would like it to be written.
Right.
Could you put this in and could you perform this for me as a sample? So the students can write their own version, but they have a backing, soundtrack that they can use if they want to. They can get an idea of what they do by listening to mine and then they would make their own with their friends and then they would upload these and they could play these in front of the class. So it was basically a summary of everything they've learned put into kind of, I guess, a rap song.
And it's, of course, the style of music is so far away from the style of music because you were also a musician in your own right where you travel the world and you played piano, but I also understand that classical music was you know, it's where you come from, or?
Music is music. And, you know, when you're a working musician, you play what people want you to play. So if I was asked to play, and I'm an accomplished classical pianist, not a concert pianist, but I can play classical music to entertain. So I would go to a hotel, for example, an upmarket hotel that wanted somebody to play classical music in their foyer. It might be in England or the US or Japan or somewhere. And I would play classical music, Chopin or Mozart, or I would play that as kind of relaxing background music in their foyers. But then sometimes they would say, look, we have a need for something a bit more upbeat. Can you play some jazz? There's a jazz band coming in. Can you play some music? So sure. So I'd kind of get my jazz head on and I'd play piano in a jazz band or double bass because I'm a double bass player as well. So I was very, very, I guess, versatile in what I played, which meant that I was always in demand. I had agents in England and America that would just put me everywhere that they could find work, and I only played in very upmarket places. I was very lucky. I had great agents. It was a fantastic life, yeah.
Yes, and of course between that, because you were you studied music and then you entered the modelling scene and you worked in London, you worked in Paris, and of course you received awards as the designer's favourite mannequin.
Yes, yes.
And then you also wrote a book that fashion icon Sandra Rhodes did wrote a forewords, glowing forewords for your book. And then you went back to being a musician.
That's right. So I studied music at university first, but it just wasn't me. I mean, I am not a person who can sit behind a piano and learn one piece of music to be played perfectly, and you sit and play that for 3 months and then perform it once. To me, that's completely pointless. There is some people love doing it. For me, it wasn't my thing at that time. I was, 17 years old, So I was picked up by a talent scout from a big agency, and they said, would you like to try out for us? And I was like, oh, give it a go. Why not? And it turned into this amazing career over a long period of time. I mean, I did find, I guess, the early days difficult because I was very angular. And in those days, it was very much the girl next door with the fluffy hair and, the girl next door look. And I was a very tall, angular, almost a Cate Blanchett look.
Right.
So it wasn't particularly fashionable in the early days. But I went to Europe and suddenly, wow. It was a completely different story because they loved the way I looked. And that was transformational for me. And it was exciting. It was a very, really interesting, I guess, way of looking at cultures too, because in those days, agents weren't international. You had an agent here and then you went overseas and you found a new agent. Nowadays, the agents will send their models to another country and they will send them to a reputable agency. I was just really lucky I landed on my feet with a fantastic agency. I just seemed to land on my feet. And I think you have to be persistent.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I try and teach my young people, the young people who do my programs, that sometimes it's just persistence. It's not last man standing, but it's kind of just keep going, just keep going. If you believe something, keep going and improve as you go. Don't give up. And that's basically, I guess, the message. And we can all learn and all improve.
Thank you so much, Natalia, for sharing your thoughts.
Well, it's wonderful to chat with you, Lisa. Yeah, I know I'm old at, because I'm keeping it cool. Follow the rules, very smart in everything that I do. I'm an individual too, always making a move.
Ain't no clues for the people thinking life is a cruise. It's time to get with the plan, man. Just take a start. Keep dreaming large, utilizing every part of your heart. Life is cool in the breeze when you're making your mark. Just like a walk in the park, get to know who you are. So know yourself, take the lead, indeed, forget the greed. Gotta believe in you, nobody can set you free. It seems if you fight, you'll achieve the things you need. Don't ever give up the hope, there's not a time to retreat. Please know you're the one that people trust. If you're down with a frown, your plans will turn to dust. If you stay in the zone, unique, you ain't a clone. There's plenty of people who know you can make it, you're not alone. People try to